Some of the stories I cover on this podcast are mostly about the person I'm interviewing. Some are mostly about the person who has been the victim. And some are mostly about the case. This story, The Suspicious Death of Samantha Sutton, will mostly be about the case, because the case largely tells the story. It tells the story of a young woman who had a rocky start to life, teenage years that involved drugs, older men, and even the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and then a tragically brief adult life in and out of jail and rehab. But looking at the case file does not tell the whole story. It doesn't tell the story of homemade soup and family outings and a young woman who just wanted to come home and just wanted to be clean. It doesn't tell of the questions that Samantha's family have been left with in the wake of her death at age 22. For those parts of the story, the parts of the story that tell us who Samantha was and the impact her loss had on her family, I spoke with her mother, Dell. I'm Charlie, and this is Impact Statement. When a crime ends in a conviction, the victims or their families are often allowed to give a statement to the court about the impact of the crime on their lives. But when these life-altering events go unsolved, do not end in a conviction, or maybe aren't crimes at all, the victims and their families do not have this opportunity. The stories on this podcast are their impact statements. Samantha was born on March 2nd, 1989, to Dell and Samuel. She grew up in Carroll County, Georgia, a county west of Atlanta and bordering the neighboring state of Alabama. Her early years involved turmoil and abuse that led to severe separation anxiety.
Her dad was an alcoholic, and he was absentee much of the time. And after he hit me and her when she was like two and a half years old, I got a restraining order against him and divorced him. She had a fear of men, and especially men and people. I had to get her and her sister in counseling by the time she was like three. Her dad continued to abuse alcohol and abuse us verbally or whatever. I would have to go to school with her in pre-K, sit in class and just like be like a teacher's aide all day.
At 10, Samantha was sexually assaulted by a 16-year-old boy who lived in their apartment complex. But in spite of the evidence against him, the young man was never prosecuted for this crime. A trauma like that would be difficult to work through for any child. But for a little girl who had already struggled with feeling safe and secure, it was more than she could handle. Samantha had to withdraw from school and be educated at home for a period of time. Samantha loved animals, and rescuing animals became a big part of her life. It's as though helping something smaller and more vulnerable than she was her way of coping with her own pain. At the age of 14, Samantha asked her mother if she could go spend the summer with her father. Dell was resistant to this idea, but she was eventually talked into it. A few months into this long visit, Dell found out that Samantha wasn't actually staying with her father. He was a truck driver and gone much of the time. And Samantha was staying with her aunt. Her aunt had a 17-year-old stepdaughter who had already been in trouble for drugs and alcohol. One night that summer at 3 a.m, Dell received a call that Samantha was missing. The attitude from Samantha's family where she was staying was that she had left on her own and she would come back on her own. But Dell knew Samantha was vulnerable and went to her ex-husband's town and drove the streets until she found Samantha. It turns out this wasn't the first time. Samantha and her cousin had been sneaking out many nights, undetected by her aunt. It was on these nights that Samantha met the people who would introduce her to drugs. One of the people Samantha met was a 26-year-old man named Derek. Samantha was 15.
That's when the drug abuse started. And then I met up with Derek, who 26 years old and her 15, and the authorities would do nothing. It appears he was prostituting her. He got her into a strip club by the time she was 16, 17 years old in Atlanta, giving her Xanax and alcohol. And two of the guys went to the police department with me that hung out with them, told the chief of police in Ranburn, Alabama, that guy, Derek, would get Samantha so drunk and on drugs that she would be lethargic, passed out, and he would have sex with her on the sofa with other people partying.
Samantha was later listed with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children as a trafficked minor. In spite of this, and the contact Dell repeatedly made with authorities for the next few years until Samantha turned 18, she was not able to get help for her daughter. Samantha's first trip to the hospital for a drug overdose was at the age of 16. The following year, Samantha decided to go to rehab. While in the store with Dell prior to going into rehab, Derek called her.
She took off. The police laughed at me and told me she was 17 years old and could go anywhere she wanted to. And within a couple of weeks, she's in ICU in Harrelson County, Bremen Hospital, for 4 days.
There would be two more drug-related trips to the emergency room in the next few months. But through all of this, it needs to be said that Samantha was trying. She would go through periods of sobriety. She enrolled in classes to get her high school equivalency diploma. But Derek and drugs would always come back into her life and derail her efforts. After a period of being missing for 3 months at the age of 17, Samantha was found in the home of a man who was in his mid-30s. Due to Samantha's drug and runaway issues, she was under the supervision of the Department of Family and Children's Services, yet she was found living with an adult man who was a known drug addict. When Samantha turned 18, things escalated. She and Derek were arrested for drug-related offenses, and Derek was charged with a misdemeanor. Samantha was charged with 4 felonies. Dell believes Derek set Samantha up to take the fall, and I can see why she thinks that. After Samantha stopped seeing Derek, she began a relationship with a man named Kevin when she was 20. When Kevin got into a traffic accident while Samantha was a passenger, he talked her into claiming she was driving. Kevin had no license due to a history of driving under the influence. Samantha, much like what it appears happened with Derek, agreed to take the rap. She would later be arrested when the car she was driving, which happened to be Kevin's mother's car, was found with a heroin needle in the trunk. Samantha was building a pattern of taking the fall for her boyfriends. This is something we do see in relationships involving coercive control and abuse. There were more court dates, days in jail and days out of jail, more tears and frustration for Dell as she tried repeatedly to get help for Samantha. Samantha was eventually given the option of 6 months in a rehabilitation center instead of jail, and she took that opportunity. It wasn't just that she wanted to get out of jail. She wanted to get clean. In February of 2011, just 2 weeks before Samantha turned 22, she wrote a letter to Kevin, breaking up with him. She realized in rehab that she had to cut out the people in her life that encouraged her using. She had to distance herself from the people who did not want her to get better. She had to stop talking to those who would not support her in her sobriety. Because of the legal situation, Samantha did not have a choice for rehab. Dell had found her a place in a secure facility, one that specialized in mental health treatment for Samantha's complex needs, in addition to substance abuse recovery. But the court instead ordered Samantha to a facility that was not locked down. It was also facilitated by someone who was related to Kevin. This woman had a child with Kevin's brother. On April 17th, Kevin arrived at the facility to visit Samantha in spite of her letter breaking things off with him from 2 months earlier. That night, she left the facility and met with Kevin. The next day when she returned, she admitted to using prescription medication and alcohol. Staying out overnight and substance abuse were both against the policy of this facility. Samantha then left the drug treatment center. Because this was a court-ordered placement, a warrant was put out for her arrest. Days after she left the facility, on April 22nd, Kevin sent Samantha a text that said, quote, "You having fun cheating on me, Samantha." It is not clear at what point after Samantha left the treatment facility that she first saw Kevin. According to him, it was on April 28th that he picked her up from Dell's house, and they were together on the 28th and the 29th. A witness has confirmed that she was with him on the 29th. Samantha had plans to see a friend that evening, but she canceled those plans because she was arguing with Kevin. While on the phone with her friend, Kevin took the phone from her and told the friend she would have to call back later. The next morning at 11:05, April 30th, Kevin called 911.
Carroll County, 911, do you have an emergency?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I just woke up. I think my girlfriend's dead.
What's all right? What's your address?
I have edited the call to remove extraneous detail.
322. 322.
All right.
What's your name?
Kevin.
Why do you think that, Kevin?
Because she's cold. I woke up and we just woke up and she's cold.
Okay. I'm gonna go ahead and get these fire and ambulance around. You hold on just a second, okay?
Okay.
What happens next on the 911 call is confusing at best. After reporting that Samantha was deceased, the dispatcher pushes Kevin a little to at least attempt CPR. When he moved Samantha from the bed to the floor and attempted CPR, there is a breathy groan that is heard. It's audible on the 911 call, and the 911 dispatcher, having heard it, believed it to mean Samantha was breathing. Because the dispatcher believed Samantha was responding to resuscitation attempts, the call for a death at the home was changed to one that indicated that Samantha was alive. Kevin was then told to turn Samantha over to her side and more sounds are heard. The fire department arrived first and Samantha was not breathing, so they began resuscitation attempts again. On Samantha's toxicology screening, it shows the drug nalorphine. This is a drug that, like Narcan, can reverse an opioid overdose, except this drug is no longer used. So on one hand, it appears there may have been an attempt to treat her for an opioid overdose. But since this drug is an older one and Narcan is the preferred drug, this remains a question for Dell. The EMTs arrived next and took over from the fire department. However, they noticed what they believed were signs that Samantha was deceased and had been for a while, such as lividity setting in. En route to the hospital, they called ahead with their new information, and they were told to stop resuscitation attempts. But what about that groan or breathing sound? A private investigator Dell had look over the files believes this may have been a sound produced due to the movement of Samantha's body after having had air blown into her lungs, and it wasn't actual breathing. When police arrived, Kevin initially told them that the previous night he had taken Samantha at her insistence to buy something called Suboxone. Like methadone, Suboxone relieves the symptoms of opioid withdrawal. Unlike methadone, which will, in very large quantities, get someone high, Suboxone will not give you a high at all, and large quantities are more likely to make you sick. Suboxone has a weak synthetic opioid in it, but it also has the drug naloxone, which is the same ingredient in the Narcan shot to combat an overdose. In short, if you try to misuse Suboxone to get high, you will find yourself in withdrawal. But where Kevin says he allegedly took Samantha for the Suboxone was not to a clinic. It was to a parking lot to buy it from a drug dealer. Obviously, drug dealers do not usually sell drugs that cause withdrawal. But Kevin says in that parking lot, Samantha instead bought $50 worth of heroin. Kevin then told two versions of what happened next. One version was that they returned home. Samantha injected the heroin around 10 p.m. and was stumbling around. She then passed out an hour and a half later in the bed. Kevin, concerned, watched her for a bit and then fell asleep himself. The other version is that she shot up in the back seat of the car while he drove them back to the apartment. She then threw the needle out of the car window, which explains why it wasn't found at the scene. When they got home, he brought her into the apartment and put her to bed, and she fell asleep around midnight. He stayed up another hour or two, again because he was concerned about her, but eventually fell asleep. It was at 10:30 the next morning Kevin said he got out of bed. He looked over and thought Samantha was just passed out. He attempted to wake her, but he was unable to do so, and she was not breathing. Additionally, she was cold to the touch. Kevin then told his roommate that he thought Samantha was dead in his room. His roommate was not interested in involving himself with the situation. He did not call 911, and he did not enter the bedroom. Kevin eventually called 911 just over 30 minutes after he first woke up. One of the firefighters who responded reported that he found Samantha warm, yet when paramedics arrived, they noted lividity, a sign she had died at least 2 hours prior. This inconsistency is just one of many that Dell has had to confront, and there is no clear answer here because it does not appear Samantha's body temperature was taken. So what is written in the reports is someone's perception of temperature. Here is an assignment. Get 3 bowls of water. Put hot water, not scalding, into one. Put ice water into one. And put room temperature water into the third. Now I want you to put your right hand in the ice water and your left hand in the hot water. Leave them in there for a minute or so. Then take both hands and put them in the room temperature water. Is the room temperature water hot or cold? Well, that's going to depend on your hand. Your right hand is telling you that the water is warm, and your left hand is telling you that it's cold, because judging hot and cold based on touch is a matter of perception. If this firefighter had cold hands, noting that Samantha felt warm is not a fact. Conversely, Kevin perceiving Samantha as cold is not a fact either. And this is why we don't rely on our perception to measure temperature. When an official report or investigative document relies on perception and the perceptions aren't consistent, it leads to confusion for the families who are looking to these documents for answers as to what happened and when. Samantha was transported to the hospital where we have more inconsistent documentation. In one place, it is listed she was dead on arrival and died at the apartment. Another lists the address for an entirely different residence as the place of death. Another says she died at the hospital as an inpatient. When Dell was called and able to get to the hospital that same day, she was told she could not see Samantha because she was already set for transport to the Georgia Bureau of Investigations for an autopsy. Her body had been identified by her father, who held her and prayed over her. He also did not perceive her to be cold. But again, either her temperature was not taken or it was not documented. 2 days later, an autopsy was performed. When the toxicology results came in, Samantha's death was ruled to be mixed drug toxicity, and the manner of death was ruled to be accidental. Due to Samantha's turbulent relationship with Kevin, Dell was concerned that this was not accidental, that this mix of drugs found in Samantha's system was the result of a hot shot. A hot shot is intravenous drugs that are spiked with something to cause death. Dell had 2 outside case reviews done. Neither were investigations, but rather evaluations of the current case file. One was done by the Parents of Murdered Children's Second Opinion Services. A retired detective agreed that Kevin should have done more and shown more care, but he did not believe it rose to the level of culpability. A doctor also looked over the file and said that the manner of death appeared to him to be either suicide or accidental, though he leaned towards accidental. The second review was done by Dell's private investigator, and she disagrees that accidental overdose is a possibility here. Samantha had multiple drugs in her system. Her toxicology screen showed she had morphine, which is a metabolite of heroin, cocaine, and a lethal dose of citalopram in her system. Citalopram is an antidepressant, best known by its brand name, Celexa. Samantha had been taking this medication by prescription for about 9 months at the time of her death. Antidepressants taken in large quantities like that is not something people do to get high. The private investigator recommends getting an expert to assess how long before Samantha's death she would have had to ingest those pills to have a lethal dose in her bloodstream. Because antidepressants, like Celexa, are not used recreationally, the private investigator feels an accidental overdose is not likely. The large dose of antidepressants was on purpose. She cannot say without further investigation if Samantha took the pills willingly or not, so she cannot say for sure if it was a suicide or homicide, though she leans towards homicide. And this would be the scenario of the hot shot. Both reviews, however, agree that the initial investigators did a good job. They treated the unattended death as suspicious from the start and did not make assumptions. However, it seems that after that, the investigation stalled. When Kevin hired a lawyer and stopped cooperating with authorities, not much more was done. The investigation into Samantha's death has been closed. Dell puts a lot of the blame for the stalled investigation on the then coroner, Sam Eady.
There was never an investigation. There was never an inquest. Sam Eady didn't even fill out what had to be filled out by law on the coroner's report if she was found dead, just left blank. He didn't sign her death certificate that was filed and sealed. And when I called the state to get something done about her death certificate to get it legal, they told me to go to the coroner's council, and the coroner's council just blew it off.
Though Kevin admitted to multiple crimes when being initially interviewed by police, he did not face any charges. This was the call of the district attorney, and this is honestly not uncommon. Georgia, like 39 other states, has immunity laws governing this. When someone calls 911 to report an overdose, they will not face arrest or prosecution for certain offenses related to the drug use. The goal of this law is to encourage people to call for help rather than to let someone die for fear of prosecution. In Georgia, this immunity also includes probation and parole violations. It is up to the district attorney if the immunity applies. And in this case, it appears the DA did decide it applies. In the aftermath of Sam's death, Dell found herself in the position to reach out and help others. She became a volunteer with Team Hope. Team Hope is a group with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They train volunteers to work with families who are dealing with missing, exploited, or recovered children. The qualification for the volunteers is that they were once in those shoes. These volunteers had once themselves walked the path as a parent of a missing or exploited child. Dell spent a weekend with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children training for this position.
I went to training about 4 years ago in Virginia for the first time. They wanted us to give one word, a description of what the last 4 days had meant to us. They called on me first. You know what come up in me and come out of me, and what happened? Empowered.
Dell took this empowerment and both dove into Samantha's case and also helped a family whose 14-year-old daughter had been lured from her home and exploited. But providing that help took its toll on Dell, and she is currently taking a break from the work. As a former Army wife, Dell borrowed a term from the military in describing where she is right now. She has battle fatigue. In the moments where she does take a break, she and her other daughter, Samantha's older sister, go out to dinner, and they laugh and they joke. It took years for Dell to make Samantha's favorite home-cooked meals, homemade soup and fried chicken, but she's found herself making them again. The family goes on picnics, as they did when Samantha was alive. But instead of the full spread she used to prepare, Dell keeps it simple. It's what she can do with where she is right now. And that's okay. That's enough. From this tragedy that feels so unfinished for Dell, she finds what peace she can with family, through prayer and by knowing her work with Team Hope has brought something good into the world that can be Samantha's legacy. If you are interested in sharing your story on Impact Statement, please email impactstatementpod@gmail.com or find me on Twitter @statementpod. Impact Statement is now on Patreon. If you'd like to donate to the show, go to patreon.com and search for Impact Statement.